Hello, welcome to the Best of Media Network Plus. I'm Keith Parent. It's very nice to have you with us on the program. We begin today with a news story before we get into the archives. Now, what are the challenges of reporting from a disaster zone? In Indonesia, more than 1,000 people have been confirmed dead after an earthquake and tsunami on the island of Sulawesi. The ABC's David Lipson discuss what it's like to cover the story from behind the scenes. And he's speaking to Thomas Arati.
Right now I'm at the markets in Palu City, which are starting to show some early signs of returning to normal. People are buying fish, buying chickens, corn, vegetables around me. The prices are vastly inflated, about three times, but at least there is a little bit of commerce going on here right now.
Now, let's take a step back for a moment. What was your first reaction when you heard about the earthquake and the tsunami warning at the time? Did you have any idea it had come to this?
No, we didn't realise it would be like this, because often tsunami warnings are issued and then lifted. And in fact, that's exactly what happened with this one. The tsunami warning was issued. We knew it was a big quake, but then the warning was lifted. And it was shortly after that, after sort of breathing a sigh of relief, that we started to see a few videos, because, you know, these days everyone has smartphones, and so unlike times of the past where you've seen these disasters, in this region anyway, they're very quickly shared. So very quickly we were seeing these horrific videos of the ocean surging into the city, but we weren't able to verify whether it was indeed this area, the city of Palu. And it was actually a billboard that showed a local politician in one of the videos that confirmed for us, okay, that's definitely Palu. He's a local politician, so this is real, this is happening.
And you eventually got there, but you're of course based in Jakarta. So how did you get to the affected areas? Can you step us through that journey?
Sure. Well, we sent our first team, led by Ann Barker and Phil Hemingway, in. We knew it would take them a couple of days to get there. So I stayed in Jakarta hoping that Palu Airport would open for commercial flights. It didn't. So in the end, we were booked on a flight, but we got kicked off the flight, so we had to find another way there. The short version is it took us a full 48 hours of travelling. I got 1 hour's sleep the first night, about Wow. 4 hours the next night, and that involved a 15-hour drive through the mountains, skimming around big landslides, waiting for bulldozers to clear the road and fighting just horrific traffic. And then when we arrived finally in Palu, the inverted commas accommodation that the others had been staying in for a couple of nights involved them sort of sleeping on the driveway of a hotel and having access at least to one toilet between about 30 people and a bucket that you could sort of wash yourself with. But when we got there, unfortunately, the owners said, "I'm really sorry, but you can't stay here. We're full. We've got 30 children arriving shortly, and you can't stay." So we ended up that first night pitching a tent on the footpath out the front, which was you know, pretty hot. There were a few big aftershocks that night. We left a tent there that following day, and when we returned, it had been stolen. But yeah. I suppose people are in great need. And, well, in Australia, I suppose if you left the tent on the nature strip, it would probably go by the end of the day as well. But then that meant that not just the tent, but a thin mattress that we had and also things like my towel and the like had gone as well. So as a result, I've kind of been, I hate to horrify your listeners, but I've been drying myself after a wash with a bucket with dirty undies.
Oh, right.
For the last few days, because that's the only way I can get the water off me.
That's all you've had. I mean, now the impact of the disaster is settling in. What are people in Palu doing at the moment? How are they responding to all of this?
Well, they're just extraordinary. They're just so positive, and they're the type of people, very religious people, that kind of just take everything in their stride, even disasters like this. I mean, a lot of the people that are fleeing absolutely look shell-shocked. They've obviously been severely traumatised, and you can see that written all over their faces, and occasionally they'll come up to you and almost beg you to tell their story to the world. But the vast majority of Palu City was not actually damaged by the quake or the tsunami, and maybe that's something that not too many people are aware of. It was really just the shorefront that was smashed, and you know, rightly so, it's received great attention, smashed by the tsunami, that is, and then random buildings, but sometimes really huge buildings, were brought crashing down by the quake. So those people that still have their homes are doing what they can to help others. They're trying to get on with things, but it's very hard in a city where there hasn't been any power or communication. You're starting to see huge mountains of trash piling up on the streets, and it's going to really be some time before you get any real sense of normal here.
And can I ask, because it wasn't that long ago we were speaking to you about the earthquakes in Lombok. How is the response effort from Indonesian authorities different this time in Sulawesi?
Well, they seem to be much more aware of what's needed. I mean, I think Lombok was a little bit of a lesson. It wasn't as big a disaster, but there was a lot of criticism of the president for his response to Lombok because he refused to accept international aid there. And, we returned there about a month after the big quake there, and people were still really struggling. And, a lot of people were perplexed about why he didn't accept international aid. Well, they have accepted international aid this time, but it's been very slow. And, in fact, there is this process that goes on here where the government first wants to fully assess things before they start deploying aid and resources. At least that's how it appears. And you lose a few crucial days doing that rather than just having faith that this is a big disaster, we need to send everything we've got. And just then working out the details later. Saying that, though, it has been just so hard to get anything in here because the airport was closed for a day and a half. All the roads were blocked and the ports were destroyed. There was really no way to get in for those first few days apart from, helicopters and the like, and they were kind of in short supply here. So you can give them some sympathy, the Indonesian government, for that. But again, President Jokowi is coming in for some criticism.
And looking at those logistical challenges, in terms of the journalism, what challenges have you come across in terms of using the technology to file your stories? We're using your mobile phone at the moment, but has that been reliable, for example?
Oh, it's been awful. That's been one of the biggest challenges and biggest stresses because we're here to do a job and, there's not a lot of point us being here if we can't get the message out. And that's how it was in many ways for the first couple of days. So we were really restricted to occasional phone calls. You couldn't rely on them. There was the signal would just come in at various times for a few minutes or an hour at various points of the day. And you'd use that time to make the phone calls you needed to make to file anything you could through those means. But we were also using the satellite phone to contact Sydney when we needed to, and what's known as a BGAN, which is essentially a little mini backpacker uplink to a satellite to send out television pictures. But it's very slow, and it's also very, very expensive to use. We don't have an unlimited budget either, so you're restricted to a certain number of minutes per day that you can use this technology. And you have to make it all work in that window.
And it's a story that's obviously making global headlines, David. Is there a sense of camaraderie between journalists working on the ground there, regardless of the fact they're working for different media outlets?
Oh, absolutely. All the sort of normal hardcore competition goes in many ways out the window and you work together. So, for example, our journey from the village of Poso through the mountains to Palu, we actually went in convoy with 9 cars, all with international media. And the reason for that is that we were hearing that cars were being stopped and robbed and looted and all the rest through the mountains. So we decided it was best to go together. And in that way, if anyone broke down or got robbed, then we'd be able to help out. We also had with us actually an Indonesian police officer who we had managed to secure to come on the journey with us. He was armed. And, we were told that several of our drivers were armed as well. So all of us kind of working together in that scenario to make sure that all of us could get here and get the message out to our respective countries.
And And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Media Network Plus, heard in North America on Sirius XM, in the UK on Sky Digital, around the world on the World Radio Network, and on great partner stations everywhere. Now, many of you know that I spent 5 years at China Radio International. During my time at CRI, I worked for the overseas department and hosted a number of programs for the domestic service, otherwise known as CRI Music. We were very lucky, and we had a very close and friendly team. Paul Pierce, Tina V, Corey Ashworth, including some fun local staff who worked on the station as well, like Li Qian, Wang Lu, and Mike D. But there was one announcer-producer that I would have to say I had a real connection with. That was Rick O'Shea. We used to hang out in between recording in the corridor of the English Language Service of CRI, talking about music, television, film, more music, complaining about the silly management at CRI, more music, technical gadgets, and more music. I think one of the reasons we connected was that we have so many of the same interests. In fact, our birthdays are only one day apart. Rick, or Li Ke, as he's also known on the air, hosted one of the most popular English language radio shows in China for over 11 years. He has just written a book called Radio Chopsticks. How appropriate. Now, there are so many things to discuss, so we can't bring you the whole lengthy conversation, but today we will bring you part one. So to begin, just imagine you're in Beijing right now. Are you doing that? Okay. Some of you seem to be thinking you're in Shanghai. Well, that's actually okay as well. And you are tuning to CRI Music, and this is what you would have heard.
Ni hao, are you my baby?
From Beijing, for China, this is Joy FM.
收音机前的朋友，你 How are you? 欢迎来到 CRI Music 晚间时段带给你的欢乐调频。
Yes, welcome to our program of Joy FM. 我是李克 I am Rick, R-I-C-K, Rick. With Jade, we say, 你 How are you? Our bilingual greeting for our Joy FM family.
他所说的 Jade 就是我的另外一个名字，王璐加李克，再加上收音机前的每一个朋友，今天晚上的聚会就到齐了。让我们共同投身于 Coco 李玟所为我们描述的一种疯狂状态 ,So crazy.
Ladies and funky gentlemen, this is the Coco Lee track. The Coco Lee. Check it out.
You're what I would call a real radio guy. You've been in many different aspects of radio, not just working as an on-air presenter, but also as a programmer. When you were growing up in the U.S., and we'll get to the work that you've done here in Asia, but the work that you started off doing, was this something that you always dreamed of doing? I mean, were you one of those kids growing up in the bedroom would talk into a toy tape recorder at the age of 10, thinking, this is what I want to do?
Good question. No. It was never anything that I thought I would ever do. I was not one of those guys who wanted to be in radio. I didn't want to be, I used to listen to a lot of radio. Growing up in Detroit, great musical place to grow up with rock and Motown, soul, we had everything. And no, I did not want to be in radio. I had no idea about it.
So what happened then? What was it that sparked your interest to going into this very, the only word I can think of is crazy career?
I'm glad you asked, because I've got a book coming out later this year that explains all of that. It's a book about my life, and it's a real story about how I got into radio, how I listened to radio, how I got into it, how I stayed in radio, and how I ended up going from Detroit to Beijing, with stops along the way for a few years in Shanghai and also in Hong Kong and Taipei and Hawaii and Florida. So it's actually all in my book. It's all a matter of fate. The real story is I got into radio I was listening to a radio station in Florida, and they sucked. They were terrible. So they said, we need people to come here and sell radio advertising. And I went to the station because now I knew where they were. And now I knew the location. I walked in there. I said, I don't really want to work here. I don't want a job as a salesperson. I just want to tell you guys suck. There's only two stations in this area, and you both are terrible. So I just came in here to file my verbal complaint, and that's how I got into radio. They hired me on the spot.
So what happened? Did they basically say to you, well, you think you know it all? Okay, come and work for us.
Actually, what they said is we're going to improve the sound of our station. You've got good ears. You know what you're listening to. And we're going to improve it. We've got some guys coming down. We want you to join us as a salesperson. And would you consider that rather than the job that you're doing outside surveying land, which I really enjoyed, actually, in Florida? And I took the job.
So you went from being a land surveyor to a broadcaster. There's no connection there, is there?
No, I didn't. You know, sometimes you take jobs that are not your career. I'm sure you've had that along the way also, Keith, where you take the job because you need the job, you need the money, but you know there's something else on the other side of that. It's not that I wanted to be a surveyor, but I loved living in Florida, being outside every day, taking coconuts off of the trees, and driving around measuring land and looking for little pieces of metal that were planted like 100 years ago that tell the location of the land.
Puff Daddy, featuring Faith Evans and a lot of people. I'll be missing you. Puff Daddy, currently known as P. Diddy, on Joy FM, Rick and Jade.
快乐音乐转不停，每天晚上送出与 CRI Music 的欢乐调频。
Words and music. Later on in this hour, Jade will take a look at a song from the number one album on the Billboard charts. The album is called Weathered from Creed, and the song is My Sacrifice.
来自主义合唱团的一首最新的单曲 My Sacrifice, 选自他们当然是刚刚出版不久的专辑，不过成绩已经让所有人刮目相看，在公告牌杂志专辑榜的第一名位置已经连续停留了八周。稍后在词曲单元当中，我们就要给大家放大这首单曲 My Sacrifice.
And words and music will appear later on in this hour of joy.
让我们共同期待吧。
Right now, the latest from Shaggy, who performed in Beijing last year. This is Dance and Shout, Shaggy on Joy, baby.
During the 30 years, because you've mainly worked in commercial radio, you've probably seen a lot of changes. I mean, even now, in 2011, we've noticed that radio is going through a transition period, because nowadays we have podcasts, we have the internet, there's so many other means for delivery, including on iPhones, on all kinds of smartphones, the iPad, sure, and everything. What has been the major transition that you have seen?
The major transition that I've seen for in these days from the old days, in the old days, you had a definite audience. And these days, you don't have that definite audience because there's so much going on around us that we don't think about it. But actually, the change is there's much more competition. For myself, I can listen to MP3. I can listen to internet radio. So radio that used to be kind of like TV as a major source of entertainment is now, you've got to be more creative to get an audience. You've got to give me a reason to go from my MP3, from my podcast, from things like that. You've got to give me a reason to go to the radio. And that's the difference. Before, you had a built-in audience. Even the mobility of radio, where people listen in their cars and people say, oh, I listen to the radio. I listen when I'm driving. Other times, do they go home and do they listen to the radio? That's the point. And programmers of radio have not really addressed this. And that's why it's kind of falling apart in many places in the world.
Now, something that we see around the world, and it's quite common in places like the United States and Canada and even some parts of Western Europe, is you will have, let's say, we'll take an example in the U.S. We could take maybe Clear Channel, for example. Mm-hmm. I have heard this myself, where you can be, let's say, in New York. You could be talking to somebody in Los Angeles. You will hear the same program and the same piece of music. It's sort of, as somebody described it, like radio turning into like a fast food chain. Mm-hmm. Do you think this is a good thing, or has radio lost something that did make it special?
I think radio lost a lot of the magic that made it special. And they're afraid to really, they're really afraid to do things. They're afraid that they're going to lose the little audience that they have. And that's just a downhill situation. I think people who do like satellite radio or like the radio that you're doing, you know, reaching around the world, it's much different because you make it so that people will want to listen to it. rather than the fast food approach to radio of it all sounding about the same and who cares. And they're afraid to sometimes people, they're really afraid to try to get an audience, to really take a chance, to be on the edge, because the rest of it I can get without stupid DJs. I can listen to all the songs that I want without somebody coming in between saying, now we have a request from Vero Beach, you know, and who cares? You know, what I want is more, I want better information from the radio.
Well, you know, something that was recently said to me, which actually is true, there were two types of people that were on air. There were the DJs that just spewed out gobbledygook. And yep. Then there were the strong on-air personalities. And it seems that nowadays, the strong on-air personalities is a lost art. I mean, there were so many great talents who were fantastic on air.
Sure. Well, it is kind of a lost art. Actually, what it really boils down to is the bottom line. I think radio stations are just barely surviving. They're not as strong as they used to be. And to survive, they're trying to spend less money on personalities and less money on their programming, and they're happy to be on the air. You know, radio station is like a piece of property. If you hold on to it long enough, the value may go up. But it doesn't always work like that. Sometimes the value goes down. If you've got an AM radio station someplace, you better be, you know, you're barely holding on to it. Because I don't have an AM radio in my collection of radios. I don't have an AM radio. I barely have an FM radio. So radio is definitely, you know, it's being challenged by other media and other things to grab your ears. The same thing with TV and movies. Do I have to go to a movie? No, I can buy the DVD. I can rent the DVD and I can stop it and make a coffee and come back to it. How nice. And the screens are bigger at home. So, you know, the electronic communication, the electronic entertainment is going through a major change. And if a radio station can change, cool. If they can't change, they just go downhill.
Eventually, you left the United States and ended up in Taiwan, where I'm sitting right now. How did that happen? Did you just wake up one day and say, you know, I've never been to Asia. I think I'm going to go get a radio gig in Asia.
No, it didn't work like that at all. Actually, I woke up one day, and the true story is I had a newspaper, and I was in between radio jobs. You know how that goes. And in between radio jobs, I was looking at a newspaper on the beach in Hawaii, and the page flew open like in a movie, and it flew to this, the pages opened up to the classifieds. And, you know, we don't find radio jobs in the classifieds, but it flew to the classifieds, and it said, radio announcer wanted Taipei. So I went down the next day, I applied, and they hired me on the spot. And then a few weeks later, I flew from Hawaii, packed up everything, and went to Taiwan. I needed a job. Basically, I needed a gig, man.
You know, that sounds pretty much like my story and how I ended up in Cuba. And actually, something that we should mention, that you and I were both Sagittarius, and our birthdays are the same.
Yours is on the 9th?
I'm on the 9th. Right? Yeah. We're separated at birth, probably. Twins. So you ended up in Taiwan, and when you came here, because Taiwan is a very different radio market, it probably was then as well. Was it shocking for you, or was it for you the same?
It wasn't as shocking as it might be if I had flown from Florida to Taiwan. But I had that in-between stop of 3 years in Hawaii, and Hawaii is such a racial mix with many Chinese and Japanese and Philippine that the Asian aspect to a living place, I'd already experienced it, and I actually liked it. So it wasn't as drastic of a change as one might think, although it was quite a difference, that's for sure.
Was the audience any different?
I think the audience was in a way the same and in a way a little bit different. They just loved listening to English radio in Taiwan. And since we were the source of English radio, it had been the Armed Forces radio, and then it changed to the station that it is right now. And it was a chance for the Chinese to learn and listen to English, which is exactly what they wanted to do. So we gave it in a form of, this is not an English class. This is not we didn't speak like, hello, good morning. It was much more, they wanted to hear a natural way, a natural usage of English. So that's what we did.
I see.
And then when you arrived in Taiwan, was your idea to maybe just stay here in Asia for a couple of years?
No, my idea was to stay for 1 year.
For 1 year?
Yeah, I had a one-year contract, and I thought maybe I'll go for 2 years. But in fact, I had a job offer in Hong Kong.
And how long have you been in Asia now?
more than 30 years. Actually, more than half my life so far.
So you went then from Taiwan to Hong Kong, which then was mm-hmm. still a British colony. Mm-hmm. What was it like working in radio then? Because Hong Kong has an amazing radio history.
It was very cool because I worked on an AM station on commercial radio. I worked there for about 11 years. And then after that, I went to the new FM bilingual station, which was much better because it wasn't all English. It was half and half English and Chinese. So we were entering the main market, and it's kind of fun to be in the main market rather than the fringe market, which only English radio is and was in Hong Kong.
You spent 15 years in Hong Kong, and mm-hmm. then you ended up in China. Was your plan just to visit all the major centers in Asia? What was going on here?
I never had a plan to move to the mainland at all. It was never anything that I considered, but one day a guy said, you know, we have a program in on the mainland, and it's made in Hong Kong, but we're now going to make it in Shanghai. So do you want to move to Shanghai and move away from Hong Kong? And that program was Joy FM, a bilingual program that was on every night. And I accepted the offer because the station I had worked at in Hong Kong was turning into a financial station. So they were taking away the music and the bilingual approach. So it was the perfect time to leave Hong Kong. But it was, again, it was an offer that was made to me over dinner one night. And that's how I ended up on the mainland. It was not something I ever thought about ever.
Now, you did Joy FM for a very long time. And, you know, I was talking recently with a radio programmer in Kitchener, Ontario. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, you could be doing a radio show in China and have maybe 5 million listeners, which in China is considered a small audience.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Which is considered a small audience. I mean, Joy FM, it's amazing when we worked together at China Radio International, and I spent 8 years in Beijing. I was impressed at how many people knew Joy FM.
Well, you know, when you're here and when you do a program that really fits the market and leads the market, then you've got something special. And we tried for that. Well, there was a purpose. We actually wanted to do that. We weren't just filling space in between songs. We wanted people to have something fresh, new, creative, and innovative. And I think that's where we brought it during the 11 years that I was on Joy FM. And amazingly, it was on every single night. How many radio programs are on every night?
And that's seven days a week.
Yeah, you know, I think give the audience a break, man. It's nice to come back on Monday and say, well, I had a great weekend. Let me tell you about it. But it was on continuously for 11 years, every single night. So, you know, new things in radio, and they don't do things the same here as they might somewhere else.
Clark, good to hear from you. Thanks for the email. 7 days, here's the latest from Craig David on Joy FM.
And next week, we'll bring you part two of my conversation with Rick O'Shea. And that's all we have time for on this edition of the Best of Media Network Plus. 73s and 88 to the ladies.